around in the night," he said. "I had such dreams." She found that in the arms of Aslan she had new reserves of patience for the wrist-straining, wiggle-waggle brush-stroke her dentist recommended for the sides of her molars. She watched with low to medium interest as Alfred achieved full uprightness through a multi-stage process of propping, levering, hoisting, bracing, and controlled tipping. A lunatic dotty of bunched and shredded diapers hung from his loins. "Look at this," he said, shaking his head. "Would you look at this?"
"I had the most wonderful night's sleep," she answered.
And how are our floaters this morning? Roving Activities Coordinator Susie Gosh asked the table in a voice like hair in a shampoo commercial. "We didn't sink last night, if that's what you mean," said Sylvia Roth. The Norwegians quickly monopolized Susie with a complicated inquiry regarding lap swimming in the larger of the Gunnar Myrdal's pools.
"Well, well, Sine," Mr. Søreblad remarked to his wife at an indiscreet volume, "this is indeed a great surprise. The Nygrens have a lengthy question for Miss Gosh this morning."
"Yes, Tig, they do always seem to have a lengthy question, don't they? They are very thorough people, our Nygrens."
Ted Roth spun half a grapefruit like a potter, stripping out its flesh.
"The story of carbon," he said, "is the story of the planet. You're familiar with the greenhouse effect?"
"It's triple tax-free," Enid said.
Alfred nodded. "I am familiar with the greenhouse effect."
"You have to actually physically clip the coupons, which sometimes I forget," Enid said.
"The Earth was very hot 4 billion years ago," said Dr. Roth. "The atmosphere was unbreathable. Methane, carbon dioxide, hydrogen sulfide.
Of course, at our age, income matters more than growth."
"Nature hadn't learned to break down cellulose. When a tree fell, it lay on the ground and got buried by the next tree that fell. This was the Carboniferous. The Earth, a lush riot. And in the course of millions and millions of years of trees falling on trees, almost all the carbon got taken from the air and buried underground. And there it stayed until yesterday, geologically speaking."
"Lap swimming, Sine. Do you suppose that this is similar to lap dancing?"
"Some people are disgusting," said Mrs. Nygren.
"What happens to a log that falls today is that funguses and microbes digest it, and all the carbon goes back into the sky. There can never be another Carboniferous, ever, because you can't ask nature to unlearn how to biodegrade cellulose."
"It's called Orphic Midland now," Enid said.
"Mammals came along when the world cooled off, frost on the pumpkin, furry things in dens. But now we have a very clever mammal that's taking all the carbon from underground and putting it back into the atmosphere."
"I think we own some Orphic Midland ourselves," Sylvia said.
"As a matter of fact," Per Nygren said, "we too own Orphic Midland."
"Per would know," said Mrs. Nygren.
"I dare say he would," said Mr. Søreblad. "Once we burn up all the coal and oil and gas," said Dr. Roth, "we'll have an antique atmosphere. A hot, nasty atmosphere that no one's seen for 300 million years. Once we've let the carbon genie out of its lithic bottle."
"Norway has superb retirement benefits. But I also supplement my national coverage with a private fund. Per checks the price of each stock in the fund every morning. There are quite a number of American stocks. How many, Per?"
46 at present," Per Nygren said. "If I am not mistaken, ORFIC is an acronym for the Oak Ridge Fiduciary Investment Corporation. The stock has maintained its value quite well and pays a handsome dividend."
"Fascinating," said Mr. Søreblad. "Where is my coffee?"
"But, Stig, do you know," said Sine Søreblad, "I am quite sure we also have this stock, Orphic Midland."
"We own a great many stocks. I can't remember every name. At the same time, too, the print in the newspaper is very tiny."
"The moral of the story is don't recycle plastic. Send your plastic to a landfill. Get that carbon underground."
"If it had been up to Al, we'd still have every penny in passbook savings."
Bury it, bury it. Stop her, the genie in the bottle. I happen to have an eye condition that makes it painful for me to read, said Mr. Ziderblatt.
Oh, really? Said Mrs. Newgren acidly. What is the medical name of this condition?
I like a cool autumn day, said Dr. Roth.
Then again, said Mrs. Newgren, I suppose that to learn the condition's name would itself necessitate painful reading.
This is a small planet.
There is lazy eye, of course, but to have two lazy eyes at once...
That is not really possible, said Mr. Newgren. The lazy eye syndrome, or amblyopia, is a condition in which one eye assumes the work of the other. Therefore, if one eye is lazy, the other is by definition pear shut up, said Mrs. Newgren.
Inga!
Waiter, refill. Imagine the Uzbek upper middle class, said Dr. Roth. One of the families had the same Ford stomper we have. In fact, the only difference between our upper middle class and their upper middle class was that none of them, not even the richest family in town, had indoor plumbing. I am aware, said Mr. Ziderblatt, that as a non-reader I am morally inferior to all Norwegians. I accept this. Flies like around something 4 days dead. Bucket of ashes that you sprinkle in the hole. Even the little way you can see down into it is farther than you want to. And a glittering Ford stomper parked in their driveway. And they're videotaping us, videotaping them. At the same time, in spite of my disability, I do manage to enjoy a pleasure or two in life.
How empty, though, Stig, our pleasures must be, said Sina Söderblad, compared to those of the Newgrens.
Yes, they do seem to experience the deep and lasting pleasures of their mind. At the same time, Sina, this is a very flattering dress you are wearing this morning. Even Mr. Newgren has been admiring this dress in spite of the deep and lasting pleasures he finds elsewhere.
Per, come along, said Mrs. Newgren. We are being insulted.
Stig, did you hear? The Newgrens have been insulted and are leaving us.
It is a great pity. They are such fun to be with.
Our children are all Easterners now, Enid said. Nobody seems to like the Midwest anymore.
Biding my time here, fella,
said a familiar voice.
The cashier at the DuPont executive dining room was an Uzbek girl. I've probably seen Uzbeks at the IKEA store in Plymouth Meeting. These aren't extraterrestrials we're talking about. Uzbeks wear bifocals. They fly on planes.
We're stopping in Philadelphia on the way home so we can eat at her new restaurant. It's called The Generator.
Enid, my gosh, that's her place? Ted and I were there 2 weeks ago.
It's a small world, Enid said. We had a terrific dinner, really memorably good.
So, in effect, we've spent $6,000 to be reminded of what a pit toilet smells like.
I'll never forget it, Alfred said.
And are grateful for that pit toilet. In terms of the actual benefits of foreign travel, in terms of what TV and books can't give you, in terms of what you can only experience firsthand, take away the pit toilet and we'd feel like we'd wasted $6,000. Shall we go rot our brains on the sun deck?
Oh, Stig, let's. I am intellectually exhausted.
Thank God for poverty. Thank God for driving on the left side of the road. Thank God for Bebel. Thank God for strange voltages and oddly shaped plugs.
Dr. Roth lowered his glasses and peered over them, observing the Swedish exodus.
I note in passing that every dress that woman owns is designed for quick removal.
I've never seen Ted so eager to get to breakfast, Sylvia said, and lunch, and dinner.
Stunning northern scenery, Roth said. Isn't that what we're here for?
Alfred lowered his eyes uncomfortably. A little fishbone of prudery was stuck in Enid's throat as well.
Do you think he really has an eye problem? She managed to say.
His eye is excellent in at least one respect.
Ted, though, stop.
That the Swedish bombshell is a stale cliché is itself a stale cliché.
Please, stop.
The retired vice president of compliance pushed his glasses back up his nose and turned to Alfred.
I wonder if we're depressed because there's no frontier anymore. because we can't pretend anymore there's a place no one's been. I wonder if aggregate depression is on the rise worldwide.
I feel so wonderful this morning, slept so well.
Lab rats become listless in overcrowded conditions.
You do, Enid, seem transformed. Just tell me this isn't related to that doctor on the D-deck. I hear stories. Stories?
The so-called cyber frontier, said Dr. Roth. But where's the wilderness?
A drug called Aslan, Sylvia said. Aslan?
The so-called space frontier, said Dr. Roth. But I like this Earth. It's a good planet. There's a scarcity of atmospheric cyanide, sulfuric acid, ammonia, which is a boast by no means every planet can make.
Grandmother's little helper, I think they call it.
But even in your big, quiet house, you feel crowded if there's a big, quiet house at the Antipodes and every point in between.
All I ask is a little privacy, Alfred said.
No beach between Greenland and the Falklands that isn't threatened with development. No acre uncleared.
Oh, dear, what time is it? Enid said. We don't want to miss that lecture.
Sylvia's different. She likes the hubbub at the docks.
I do like the hubbub, Sylvia said.
Gangways, portholes, stevedores. She likes the blast of the horn. To me, this is a floating theme park.
You have to put up with a certain amount of fantasy, Alfred said. It can't be helped.
Uzbekistan didn't agree with my stomach, Sylvia said.
I like all the waste up here, said Dr. Roth. Good to see such vast, useless mileage.
You romanticize poverty.
I beg your pardon?
We've traveled in Bulgaria, Alfred said. I don't know about Uzbekistan, but we've traveled in China. Everything, as far as you could see from the railroad, if it were up to me, I'd tear it all down. Tear it down and start over. The houses don't have to be pretty, just make them solid. Get the plumbing indoors. A good concrete wall and a roof that doesn't leak, that's what these people need. Sewers. Look at the Germans, what they did to rebuild. There's a model of a country.
Wouldn't want to eat a fish out of the Rhine, though, if I could even find a fish in it.
That's a lot of environmentalist nonsense.
Alfred, you're too smart a man to call it nonsense.
I am in need of a bathroom.
Al, when you're done, why don't you take a book outside and read for a while? Sylvie and I are going to the investment lecture. You just sit in the sun and relax, relax, relax.
He had good days and bad days. It was as if when he lay in bed for a night, certain humors pooled in the right or wrong places, like marinade around a flank steak. And in the morning, his nerve endings either had enough of what they needed or did not. As if his mental clarity might depend on something as simple as whether he'd lain on his side or on his back the night before. Or, as if, more disturbingly, he were a damaged transistor radio, which after a vigorous shaking might function loud and clear, or spew nothing but a static laced with unconnected phrases, the odd strain of music. Still, even the worst morning was better than the best night. In the morning, every process quickened, speeding his meds to their destinations. The canary yellow spanule for incontinence, the small pink Tums-like thing for the shakes, the white oblong to discourage nausea, the wan blue tablet to squelch hallucinations from the small pink Tums-like thing. In the morning, the blood was crowded with commuters, the glucose peons, lactic and ureic sanitation workers, hemoglobinous delivery men carrying loads of freshly brewed oxygen in their dented vans, the stern foremen like insulin, the enzymic middle managers and executive epinephrine, leukocyte cops and EMS workers, expensive consultants arriving in their pink and white and canary yellow limos, everyone riding the aortal elevator and dispersing through the arteries. Before noon, the rate of worker accidents was tiny. The world was newborn. He had energy. From the Kierkegaard room, he lopingly careened through a red-carpeted hallway that had previously vouchsafed him a comfort station, but this morning seemed all business, no M or W in sight, just salons and boutiques and the Ingmar Bergman cinema. The problem was that his nervous system could no longer be relied on for an accurate assessment of his need to go. At night, his solution was to wear protection. By day,
His solution was to visit a bathroom hourly and always to carry his old black raincoat in case he had an accident to hide. The raincoat had the added virtue of offending Enid's romantic sensibilities, and his hourly stops the added virtue of lending structure to his life. Simply holding things together, simply keeping the ocean of night terrors from breaching the last bulkhead, was his ambition now. Throngs of women were streaming toward the long-stocking ballroom. A strong eddy in their current swept Alfred into a hallway lined with the staterooms of onboard lecturers and entertainers. At the end of this hall, a men's room beckoned. An officer in epaulets was using one of the two urinals. Afraid of failing to perform under scrutiny, Alfred entered a stall and slid the bolt and found himself face to face with an ordure-strafed toilet which fortunately said nothing, merely stank. He exited and tried the next stall, but here something did scurry on the floor, a mobile turd ducking for cover, and he didn't dare enter. In the meantime, the officer had flushed, and as he turned from his urinal, Alfred recognized his blue cheeks and rose-tinted eyeglasses, his pudenda pink lips. Hanging from his still-open zipper was 12 inches or more of limp tan tubing. A yellow grin opened between his blue cheeks. He said, "I left a little treasure in your bed, Mr. Lambert, to replace the one I took." Alfred reeled out of the bathroom and fled up a staircase, higher and higher, up 7 flights to the open air of the sports deck. Here he found a bench in hot sunlight. From the pocket of his raincoat, he took a map of Canada's maritime provinces and tried to fix himself within a grid, identify some landmarks. 3 old men in Gore-Tex parkas were standing at the rail. Their voices were inaudible one moment and fully distinct the next. Apparently, the wind had pockets in its fluid mass, small spaces of stillness through which a sentence or two might find a way. "Here's a fellow with a map," a man said. He came over to Alfred, looking happy in the way of all men in the world except Alfred. "Excuse me, sir, what do you reckon we're looking at up here on the left?"
"That is the Gaspé Peninsula," Alfred answered firmly. "There should be a large town coming up around the bend."
"Thank you very much."
The man returned to his companions. As if the ship's location mattered to them greatly, as if only the quest for this information had brought them to the sports deck to begin with, all three immediately departed for a lower deck, leaving Alfred alone on top of the world. The protective sky was thinner in this country of northern water. Clouds ran in packs, resembling furrows in a field, gliding along beneath the sky's enclosing dome, which was noticeably low. One approached Ultima Thule here. Green objects had red coronas. In the forests that stretched west to the limit of visibility, as in the purposeless rushing of the clouds, as in the air's supernal clarity, there was nothing local. Odd to glimpse infinity precisely in a finite curve, eternity precisely in the seasonal. Alfred had recognized the blue-cheeked man in the bathroom as the man from Signals, as betrayal personified. But the blue-cheeked man from Signals couldn't possibly afford a luxury cruise, and this worried him. The blue-cheeked man came from the distant past but was walking and talking in the present. And the turd was a creature from the night, but was afoot in broad daylight. And this worried him a lot. According to Ted Roth, holes in the ozone layer started at the poles. It was during the long Arctic night that the Earth's shell first weakened, but once the shell was punctured, the damage spread outward, encroaching even on the sunny tropics, even the equator, and soon no spot on the globe was safe. Meanwhile, an observatory in the far nether regions had sent out a feeble signal, an ambiguous message. Alfred received the signal and wondered what to do about it. He felt shy of bathrooms now, but he couldn't very well drop his trousers out here in the open. The 3 men might return at any moment. Beyond a protective railing to his right was a collection of thickly painted planes and cylinders, 2 navigational spheres, an inverted cone. Since he was not afraid of heights, nothing prevented him from ignoring the strongly worded warning in four languages, squeezing past the railing and stepping out onto the sandpapery metal surface to seek, as it were, a tree to pee behind. He was high above everything and invisible. But too late. Both legs of his trousers were very soaked, the left leg nearly to his ankle. Warm, cold wetness all over everything. And where a town should have appeared on the coast, the land instead was dropping away. Gray waves marched across strange waters, and the tremor of the engines became more labored, less easy to ignore. The ship either had not reached the Gaspé Peninsula or had already passed it. The data he'd transmitted to the men in Parkas was faulty. He was lost. And from the deck immediately below him came a wind-borne giggle. It came again, a trilling squeal, a northern lark. He edged away from the spheres and cylinders and leaned out past the outer railing. A few yards farther astern was a small Nordic sunbathing area, sequestered behind cedar fencing. And a man standing where no passenger was permitted to stand could see right over the fencing and behold Sina Söderblad, her chill-stippled arms and thighs and belly, the plump twin cloudberries into which a suddenly gray winter sky had drawn her nipples, the quaking ginger fur between her legs. The day world floated on the night world, and the night world tried to swamp the day world, and he worked and worked to keep the day world watertight. But there had been a grievous breach. Came another cloud then, larger, denser, that turned the gulf below it to a greenish-black, ship and shadow in collision. And shame and despair. Or was it the wind catching the sail of his raincoat? Or was it the ship's pitching, or the tremor in his legs, or the corresponding tremor of the engines, or a fainting spell, or vertigo's standing invitation, or the relative warmth of open water's invitation to someone soaked and freezing in the wind? Or was he leaning deliberately to glimpse again the gingery Mons?
"How fitting it is," said internationally noted investment counselor Jim Crolius, "to be talking money on a Nordic Pleasure Line's luxury fall color cruise. Folks, it's a beautiful sunny morning, isn't it?" Crolius was speaking from a lectern beside an easel on which the title of his talk, Surviving the Corrections, was written in purple ink. His question brought murmurs of assent from the first few rows in front of him, the people who'd arrived early for good seats. Someone up there even said, "Yes, Jim." Enid felt ever so much better this morning, but a few atmospheric disturbances still lingered in her head. For example, a squall now consisting of A, resentment of the women who'd come to the long-stocking ballroom absurdly early, as if the potential lucrativeness of Jim Crolius's advice might somehow decline with one's distance from him, and B, particular resentment of the pushy New York kind of woman who elbowed in ahead of everyone to establish a first-name relationship with a lecturer. She was sure that Jim Crolius could see right through their presumption and hollow flattery, but he might be too polite to ignore them and focus on less pushy and more deserving Midwestern women such as Enid. And C, intense irritation with Alfred for having stopped in a bathroom twice on the way to breakfast, which had prevented her from leaving the Kierkegaard room early and securing a good front-row seat herself. Almost as soon as the squall had gathered, it disappeared, however, and the sun shone strongly again.
"Well, I hate to break it to you folks in the back," Jim Crolius was saying, "but from where I stand, up here by the windows, I can see some clouds on the horizon. Those could be friendly little white clouds, or they could be dark rain clouds. Appearances can be deceiving. From where I stand, I may think I see a safe course ahead, but I'm no expert. I may be piloting the ship straight into a reef. Now, you wouldn't want to sail on a ship without a captain, would you? A captain who's got all the maps and gadgets, all the bells and whistles, the whole 9 yards, right? You got your radar, you got your sonar, you got your global positioning system. Jim Crolius was counting off each instrument on his fingers. You got your satellites up in outer space. It's all pretty technical. But somebody's got to have that information or we could all be in big trouble, right? This is a deep ocean. This is your life. So what I'm saying is you may not want to master all that technical stuff personally, all the bells and whistles, the whole nine yards, but you better hope you've got a good captain when you go cruising the high seas of high finance. There was applause from the front rows.
He must literally think we're 8 years old, Sylvia Roth whispered to Enid.
This is just his introduction, Enid whispered back.
Now, another way this is fitting, Jim Crolius continued, is that we're here to see the changing leaves. The year has its rhythms, winter, spring, summer, fall. The whole thing is cyclical. You got your upswings in the spring, you got your downturns in the fall. It's just like the market. Cyclical business, right? You can have a bull market for 5, 10, even 15 years. We've seen it in our lifetime, but we've also seen corrections. I may look like I'm just a kid, but I've even seen a genuine market break in my lifetime. Scary stuff. Cyclical business. People, we've got a lot of green out there right now. It's been a long, glorious summer. In fact, let me see a show of hands here. How many of you are paying for this cruise, either entirely or in part, on the strength of your investments?
Forest of raised hands.
Jim Crolius nodded with satisfaction.
Well, folks, I hate to break it to you, but those leaves are starting to turn. No matter how green things are for you right now, it's not going to survive the winter. Of course, every year is different. Every cycle is different. You never know exactly when that green is going to turn, but we're here, every one of us, because we're foresighted people. Every person in this room has proved to me she's a smart investor just by virtue of being here. You know why? Because it was still summer when you left home. Every person in this room had the foresight to know that something was going to change on this cruise, and the question we all have, I'm speaking in metaphors here, the question is, will all that glorious green out there turn to glorious gold? Or will it all just wither on the branch in the winter of our discontent?
The long-stocking ballroom was electric with excitement now. There were murmurs of marvelous, marvelous. More matter and less art, Sylvia Roth said dryly. Death, Enid thought. He was talking about death. And all the people clapping were so old. But where was the sting of this realization? Aslan had taken it away. Jim Crolius turned now to the easel and flipped over the first of its big newsprint pages. The second page was headed, When the Climate Changes, and the categories, funds, bonds, common stock, etc., drew a gasp from the front row out of all proportion to the informational content. For an instant it seemed to Enid as if Jim Crolius were doing a technical market analysis of the kind that her broker in St. Jude had told her never to pay attention to. Discounting the minimal effects of wind drag at low velocities, something plummeting, a thing of value plunging in a free fall, experienced an acceleration due to gravity of 32 feet per second squared, and acceleration being the second-order derivative of distance, the analyst could integrate once over the distance the object had fallen, roughly 30 feet, to calculate its velocity, 42 feet per second, as it passed the center of a window, 8 feet tall, and assuming a 6-foot-long object, and also assuming, for simplicity's sake, a constant velocity over the interval, derive a figure of approximately 0.4 seconds of full or partial visibility. 0.4 seconds wasn't much. If you were looking aside and mentally adding up the hours until the execution of a young killer, all that registered was something dark flashing by. But if you happened to be gazing directly at the window in question, and you happened as well to be feeling unprecedentedly calm, 0.4 seconds was more than enough time to identify the falling object as your husband, of 47 years. To notice that he was wearing the awful black raincoat, which had lost its shape and should never have been worn in public, but which he'd willfully packed for the trip and willfully carried with him everywhere. To experience not only the certainty that something terrible had happened, but also a peculiar sense of intrusion, as if you were witnessing an event that nature had never intended you to witness, like the impact of a meteorite or the copulation of whales. And even to observe the expression on your husband's face, to register its almost youthful beauty, its peculiar serenity. For who could have anticipated the grace with which the raging man would fall? He was remembering the nights he'd sat upstairs with one or both of his boys or with his girl in the crook of his arm, their damp, bath-smelling heads hard against his ribs as he read aloud to them from Black Beauty or the Chronicles of Narnia. How his voice alone, its palpable resonance, had made them drowsy. These were evenings, and there were hundreds of them, maybe thousands, when nothing traumatic enough to leave a scar had befallen the nuclear unit. Evenings of plain vanilla closeness in his black leather chair. Sweet evenings of doubt between the nights of bleak certainty. They came to him now, these forgotten counter-examples, because in the end, when you were falling into water, there was no solid thing to reach for but your children. The Generator. Robin Passafaro was a Philadelphian from a family of troublemakers and true believers. Robin's grandfather and her uncles, Jimmy and Johnny, were all unreconstructed Teamsters. The grandfather, Fazio, had served under the Teamsters' boss, Frank Fitzsimmons, as a national vice president and had run the biggest Philly local and mishandled the dues of its 3,200 members for 20 years. Fazio had survived two racketeering indictments, a coronary, a laryngectomy, and 9 months of chemotherapy before retiring to Sea Isle City on the Jersey coast, where he still hobbled out onto a pier every morning and baited his crab traps with raw chicken. Uncle Johnny, Fazio's eldest son, got along well on two kinds of disability, chronic and severe lumbar pain, the claim forms stated, his seasonal cash-only house-painting business, and his luck or talent as an online day trader. Johnny lived near Veterans Stadium with his wife and their youngest daughter in a vinyl-sided row house that they'd expanded until it filled their tiny lot from the sidewalk to the rear property line. A flower garden and a square of astroturf were on the roof. Uncle Jimmy, Baby Jimmy, was a bachelor and the site manager for IBT Document Storage, a cinder block mausoleum that the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, in more optimistic times, had built on the industrial banks of the Delaware, and later, because only three loyal Teamsters had ever opted for interment in its 1,000 fireproof vaults, converted into a long-term repository for corporate and legal paper. Baby Jimmy was famous in local N.A. circles for having hooked himself on methadone without ever trying heroin. Robin's father, Nick, was Fazio's middle child and the only Passafaro of his generation who never got with the Teamster program. Nick was the family brain and a committed socialist. The Teamsters, with their Nixonian and Sinatran allegiances, were anathema to him. Nick married an Irish girl and pointedly moved out to racially integrated Mount Airy and embarked on a career of teaching high school social studies in the city district, daring principals to fire him for his ebullient Trotskyism. Nick and his wife, Colleen, had been told that they were infertile. They adopted a year-old boy, Billy, a few months before Colleen became pregnant with Robin, the first of three daughters. Robin was a teenager before she learned that Billy was adopted, but her earliest emotional memories from childhood, she told Denise, were of feeling helplessly privileged. There was probably a good diagnostic label for Billy, corresponding to abnormal EEG waveforms or troubled red nodules or black lacunae on his CAT scan, and to hypothetical causes like severe neglect or cerebral trauma in his pre-adoptive infancy. But his sisters, Robin especially, knew him simply as a terror. Billy soon figured out that no matter how cruel he was to Robin, she would always blame herself. If she lent him $5, he made fun of her for thinking he would pay it back. If she complained to her father, Nick just gave her another $5. Billy chased her with the grasshoppers whose legs he'd clipped the ends off, the frogs he'd bathed in Clorox, and he told her, he meant it as a joke, "I hurt them because of you." He put turds of mud in Robin's doll's underpants. He called her Cow Clueless and Robin No Breast. He stuck her forearm with a pencil and broke the lead off deep. The day after a new bicycle of hers disappeared from the garage, he turned up with a good pair of black roller skates that he said he'd found on Germantown Avenue and that he used to rocket around the neighborhood in the months while she was waiting for another bike. Their father, Nick, had eyes for every injustice in the first and third worlds, except those of which Billy was the author. By the time Robin started high school, Billy's delinquency had driven her to padlock her closet, stuff Kleenex in the keyhole of her bedroom door, and sleep with her wallet beneath her pillow. But even these measures she took more sadly than angrily. She had little to complain of, and she knew it. She and her sisters were poor and happy in their big falling-down house on Philalina Street, and she went to a good Quaker high school, and then to an excellent Quaker college, both on full scholarships, and she married her college boyfriend and had two baby girls, while Billy was going down the tubes. Nick had taught Billy to love politics, and Billy had repaid him by taunting him with the epithet, bourgeois liberal, bourgeois liberal. When this failed to incense Nick sufficiently, Billy befriended the other pacifaros, who were predisposed to love any traitor in the family traitor's family. After Billy was arrested on his second felony charge, and Colleen threw him out of the house, his Teamster relatives gave him something of a hero's welcome. It was a while before he fully wore it out. He lived for a year with his Uncle Jimmy, who well into his 50s felt happiest among like-minded adolescents with whom he could share his large collections of guns and knives, Chasey Lane videos, and Warlords 3 and Dungeon Master paraphernalia. But Jimmy also worshipped Elvis Presley at a shrine in one corner of his bedroom. And Billy, who never got it through his head that Jimmy wasn't joking about Elvis, finally desecrated the shrine in some grievous and irreversible manner that Jimmy afterward refused to talk about, and was put out on the street. From there, Billy drifted into the radical underground scene in Philly, that red crescent of bomb-makers and Xeroxers and Zinesters and punks and Bakuninites and minor vegan prophets and orgone blanket manufacturers and women named Africa and amateur Engels biographers and Red Army Brigade émigrés that stretched from Fishtown and Kensington in the north over through Germantown and West Philly, where Mayor Good had firebombed the good citizens of Move, and down into blighted Point Breeze. It was an odd Philly fact that a non-negligible fraction of the city's crimes were committed with political consciousness. After Frank Rizzo's first mayoralty, nobody could pretend that the city police force was clean or impartial. And since, in the estimation of Red Crescent denizens, all cops were murderers or, at the very least, ipso facto accessories to murder, witness Move, any crime of violence or wealth redistribution to which a cop might object could be justified as a legitimate action in a long-running dirty war. This logic, by and large, eluded local judges, however. The young anarchist, Billy Pasifaro, over the years, drew ever more severe sentences for his crimes, probation, community service, experimental penal boot camp, and finally the state pen at Greaterford. Robin and her father often argued about the justice of these sentences, Nick stroking his linen-like goatee and asserting that, although not a violent man himself, he was not opposed to violence in the service of ideals, Robin challenging him to specify what political ideal exactly Billy had advanced by stabbing a Penn undergrad with a broken pool cue. The year before Denise met Robin, Billy was released on parole and attended a ribbon-cutting ceremony for a community computing center in the poor, near-north neighborhood of Nicetown. One of the many policy coups of Mayor Good's popular two-term successor was the commercial exploitation of the city's public schools. The mayor had shrewdly cast the deplorable neglect of the schools as a business opportunity. "Act fast. Be part of our message of hope," his letters said. And the N Corporation had responded to his pitch by assuming responsibility for the city's severely underfunded school athletic programs. Now the mayor had midwifed a similar arrangement with the W Corporation, which was donating to the city of Philadelphia sufficient units of its famous global desktop to empower every classroom in the city, plus 5 community computing centers in blighted northern and western neighborhoods. The agreement granted W the exclusive right to employ for promotional and advertising purposes all classroom activities within the school district of Philadelphia, including, but not limited to, all global desktop applications. Critics of the mayor alternately denounced the sellout and complained that W was donating its slow and crash-prone version 4.0 desktops to the schools and its nearly useless version 3.2 technology to the community computing centers. But the mood in Nicetown on that September afternoon was buoyant. The mayor and W's 28-year-old corporate image vice president, Rick Flamberg, joined hands on big shears to cut ribbon. Local politicians of color said children and tomorrow. They said digital and democracy and history. Outside the white tent, the usual crowd of anarchists, eyed warily by a police detail that was later criticized as having been too small, openly carried banners and placards and privately, in the pockets of their cargo pants, carried powerful bar magnets with which they hoped, amid the cake-eating and punch-drinking and confusion, to erase much data from the center's new global desktops. Their banners said, "Refuse it," and "Computers are the opposite of revolution," and "This heaven gives me migraine." Billy Passafaro, neatly shaved and wearing a short-sleeve white button-down, carried a 4-foot length of 2x4 on which he'd written, "Welcome to Philadelphia." When the official ceremonies ended, and the scene became more appealingly anarchic, Billy edged into the crowd, smiling and holding aloft his message of goodwill, until he was close enough to the dignitaries that he could swing the 2x4 like a baseball bat and break Rick Flamberg's skull. 3 further blows demolished Flamberg's nose, jaw, collarbone, and most of his teeth before the mayor's bodyguard tackled Billy and a dozen cops piled on. Billy was lucky the tent was too crowded for the cops to shoot him. He was also lucky, given the obvious premeditation of his crime and the politically awkward shortage of white inmates on death row, that Rick Flamberg didn't die. Less clear was whether Flamberg himself, an unmarried Dartmouth grad whom the attack left palsied, disfigured, slurred of speech, blind in one eye, and prone to incapacitating headaches, felt lucky about this. Billy was indicted for attempted murder, first-degree assault, and assault with a deadly weapon. He categorically rejected any plea agreement and chose to represent himself in court, dismissing as accommodationist both his court-appointed counsel and the old Teamster attorney who offered to bill his family $50 an hour. To the surprise of nearly everyone but Robin, who had never doubted her brother's intelligence, Billy mounted an articulate self-defense. He argued that the mayor's sale of the children of Philadelphia into the techno-slavery of the W Corporation represented a clear and present public danger to which he'd been justified in responding violently.
He denounced the unholy connivance of American business and American government. He compared himself to the Minutemen at Lexington and Concord. When Robin much later showed Denise the trial transcript, Denise imagined bringing Billy and her brother Chip together over dinner and listening while they compared notes about the bureaucracy. But this dinner would have to wait until Billy had served 70% of his 12- to 18-year sentence at Greaterford. Nick Passafaro had taken a leave of absence and loyally attended his son's trial. Nick went on TV and said everything you'd expect from an old red. Once a day the victim's black and there's silence. Once a year the victim's white and there's an outcry. And my son will pay dearly for his crime, but W will never pay for its crimes. And the Rick Flambergs of the world have made billions selling phony violence to America's children. Nick concurred in most of Billy's courtroom arguments and was proud of his performance. But after the photos of Flamberg's injuries were introduced in court, he began to lose his grip. The deep V-shaped indentations in Flamberg's cranium, nose, jaw, and clavicle spoke to a savagery of exertion, a madness that didn't square well with idealism. Nick stopped sleeping as the trial progressed. He stopped shaving and lost his appetite. At Colleen's insistence, he saw a psychiatrist and came home with medications, but even then he woke her in the night. He shouted, "I won't apologize!" He shouted, "It's a war!" Eventually, his dosages were upped, and in April, the school district retired him. Because Rick Flamberg had worked for the W Corporation, Robin felt responsible for all of this. Robin had become the Passafaro ambassador to Rick Flamberg's family, showing up at the hospital until Flamberg's parents had spent their anger and suspicion and recognized that she was not her brother's keeper. She sat by Flamberg and read Sports Illustrated to him. She walked alongside his walker as he shuffled up a corridor. On the night of the second of his reconstructive surgeries, she took his parents to dinner and listened to their frankly, boring stories about their son. She told them how quick Billy had been, how in fourth grade he'd already had the spelling and handwriting skills to forge a plausible note excusing him from school. And what a fund of dirty jokes and important reproductive information he was. And how it felt to be a smart girl and see your equally smart brother make himself more stupid by the year, as if specifically to avoid becoming a person like you. How mysterious it all was, and how sorry she felt about what he'd done to their son. On the eve of Billy's trial, Robin invited her mother to go to church. Colleen had been confirmed as a Catholic, but she hadn't taken communion in 40 years. Robin's own church experience was confined to weddings and funerals. Nevertheless, on 3 consecutive Sundays, Colleen agreed to be picked up in Mount Airy and driven to her childhood parish, St. Dymphna's, in North Philly. Leaving the sanctuary on the 3rd Sunday, Colleen told Robin, in the faint brogue she'd retained all her life, "That'll do for me, thanks." After that, Robin went by herself to Mass at St. Dymphna's and by, to confirmation classes. Robin could afford the time for these good works and acts of devotion because of the W Corporation. Her husband, Brian Callahan, was the son of a local small-time manufacturer and had grown up comfortably in Ballachinwid, playing lacrosse and developing sophisticated tastes in expectation of inheriting his father's small specialty chemical company. Callahan Pear, in his youth, had profitably developed a compound that could be thrown into Bessemer converters and patch their cracks and ulcers while their ceramic walls were still hot. Brian had married the prettiest girl in his college class. In his opinion, this was Robin, and soon after graduation he'd become president of High Temp Products. The company was housed in a yellow brick building in an industrial park near the Tacony-Palmyra Bridge. By coincidence, its nearest living commercial neighbor was IBT Document Storage.
The cerebral drain of running high-temp products being minimal, Brian spent his executive afternoons noodling around with computer code and Fourier analysis, blasting on his presidential boombox certain cult California bands to which he was partial, Fibulator, Thinking Fellers Union, the Minutemen, the Pneumatics, and writing a piece of software that in the fullness of time he quietly patented, quietly found a VC backer for, and one day, on the advice of this backer, quietly sold to the W Corporation for $19,500,000. Brian's product, called EigenMelody, processed any piece of recorded music into an eigenvector that distilled the song's tonal and melodic essence into discrete, manipulable coordinates. An EigenMelody user could select a favorite Moby song, and EigenMelody would spectroanalyze her choice, search a recorded music database for songs with similar eigenvectors, and produce a list of kindred sounds that the user might otherwise have never found. The Au Pairs, Laura Nero, Thomas Mapfumo, Pokrovsky's wailing version of Les Noces. EigenMelody was parlor game, musicological tool, and record sales enhancer rolled into one. Brian had worked enough kinks out of it that the behemoth of W, belatedly scrambling for a piece of the online music distribution action, came running to him with a big wad of Monopoly money in its outstretched hand. It was characteristic of Brian, who hadn't mentioned the impending sale to Robin, that on the evening of the day the deal went through, he didn't breathe a word of it until the girls were in bed in their modest yuppie row house near the art museum, and he and she were watching a Nova show about sunspots. "Oh, by the way," Brian said, "neither of us ever has to work again." It was characteristic of Robin, her excitability, that on receiving this news, she laughed until she got the hiccups. Alas, there was justice in Billy's old epithet for Robin, cow clueless. Robin was under the impression that she already had a good life with Brian. She lived in her townhouse, grew vegetables and herbs in her little backyard, taught language arts to 10- and 11-year-olds at an experimental school in West Philly, sent her daughter Sinead to an excellent private elementary school on Fairmount Avenue, and her daughter Erin to the preschool program at Friends Select, bought soft-shell crabs and Jersey tomatoes at the Reading Terminal Market, took weekends and Augusts at Brian's family's house at Cape May, socialized with old friends who had children of their own, and burned off enough sexual energy with Brian — she ideally liked it daily, she told Denise — to keep her halfway calm. Cow Clueless was therefore shocked by Brian's next question. He asked her where she thought they should live. He said he was thinking of Northern California. He was also thinking of Provence, New York, and London. "We're happy here," Robin said. "Why go someplace where we don't know anybody and everybody's a millionaire?" "Climate," Brian said. "Beauty, safety, culture, style, none of which are Philly's long suit. I'm not saying let's move. I'm just saying tell me if there's any place you'd like to go, even for a summer."
"I like it here."
"So we'll stay here," he said, "until you feel like going someplace else." She was naive enough, she told Denise, to think this ended the discussion. She had a good marriage, stably founded on child-rearing, eating, and sex. It was true that she and Brian had different class backgrounds, but high-temp products wasn't exactly E.I. DuPont de Nemours. And Robin, holding degrees from two elite schools, wasn't your typical proletarian. Their few real differences came down to style, and these differences were mostly invisible to Robin because Brian was a good husband and a nice guy, and because, in her cow innocence, Robin couldn't imagine that style had anything to do with happiness. Her musical tastes ran to John Prine and Etta James. And so Brian played Prine and James at home, and saved his bar talk and defunct and flaming lips and Mission of Burma for blasting on his boombox at high temp.
that Robin dressed like a grad student in white sneakers and a purple nylon shell and oversized round wire frames of a kind last worn by fashionable people in 1978 didn't altogether disappoint Brian, because he alone among men got to see her naked. That Robin was high-strung and had a penetrating, screechy voice, and a kookaburra laugh seemed, likewise, a small price to pay for a heart of gold and an eye-popping streak of lechery and a racing metabolism that kept her movie actress thin. That Robin never shaved her armpits and too seldom washed her glasses, well, she was the mother of Brian's children, and as long as he could play his music and tinker with his tensors by himself, he didn't mind indulging in her the anti-style that liberal women of a certain age wore as a badge of feminist identity. This, at any rate, was how Denise imagined Brian had solved the problem of style, until the money from W came rolling in. Denise, though only 3 years younger than Robin, could not conceive of wearing a purple nylon parka or failing to shave her armpits. She didn't even own white sneakers. Robin's first concession to her new wealth was to spend the summer house-hunting with Brian. She'd grown up in a big house, and she wanted her girls to grow up in one, too. If Brian needed 12-foot ceilings and 4 baths and mahogany details throughout, she could live with that. On the 6th of September, they signed a contract on a grand brownstone on Panama Street, near Rittenhouse Square. 2 days later, with all the strength in his prison-built shoulders, Billy Passafaro welcomed W's corporate image vice president to Philadelphia. What Robin needed to know, and couldn't find out, in the weeks following the attack, was whether, by the time he lettered his message on a 2x4, Billy had learned of Brian's windfall and knew which company she and Brian owed their sudden wealth to. The answer mattered, mattered, mattered. However, it was pointless to ask Billy. She knew she wouldn't get the truth from Billy. She'd get whatever answer he believed would hurt her worst. Billy had made it abundantly clear to Robin that he would never stop sneering at her, never address her as a peer, until she could prove to him that her life was as fucked up and miserable as his. And it was precisely this totemic role she seemed to play for him. Precisely the fact that he'd singled her out as the archetypical possessor of the happy, normal life he couldn't have, that made her feel as if hers were the head he'd swung for when he brained Rick Flamberg. Before the trial, she asked her father if he'd told Billy that Brian had sold Eigenmelody to W. She didn't want to ask him, but she couldn't not. Nick, because he gave Billy money, was the only person in the family still in regular communication with him. Uncle Jimmy had promised to shoot the desecrator of his shrine, the little prick nephew, if he ever showed his little prick Elvis-hating face again. And eventually, Billy had stolen once too often from everybody else. Even Nick's parents, Fazio and Carolina, who had long insisted that there was nothing wrong with Billy but, in Fazio's words, attentive deficiency disorder, no longer let their grandson inside their Sea Isle city house. Nick, unfortunately, grasped the import of Robin's question right away. Choosing his words carefully, he replied that no, he didn't recall saying anything to Billy.
"It's better if you just tell me the truth, Dad," Robin said.
"Well, I don't think there's any connection there, Robin.
Maybe it wouldn't make me feel guilty. Maybe it would just piss me off."
"Well, Robin, those feelings often amount to the same thing anyway. Guilt, anger, same thing, right? But don't you worry about Billy."
She hung up, wondering whether Nick was trying to protect her from her guilt, trying to protect Billy from her anger, or simply spacing out under the strain. She suspected it was a combination of all three. She suspected that during the summer her father had mentioned Brian's windfall to Billy, and that father and son had then traded snidenesses and bitternesses about the W Corporation and bourgeois Robin and leisure class Brian.
She suspected this, if nothing else, because of how badly Brian and her father got along. Brian was never as outspoken with his wife as he was with Denise. "Nick's the worst kind of coward," he remarked to her once. But he made no secret of hating Nick's bad boy disquisitions on the uses of violence and his teeth-sucking satisfaction with his so-called socialism. Brian liked Colleen well enough. She sure got a raw deal in that marriage, he remarked to Denise, but shook his head and left the room whenever Nick began holding forth. Robin didn't let herself imagine what her father and Billy had said about her and Brian, but she was pretty sure that things were said and that Rick Flamberg had paid the price. Nick's response to the trial photographs of Flamberg lent further credence to this view. During the trial, as her father fell apart, Robin studied the catechism at St. Dymphna's and made two further claims on Brian's new money. First, she quit her job at the experimental school. She was no longer satisfied to work for parents paying $23,000 a year per child, although, of course, she and Brian were paying nearly that much to school Sinead and Aaron. And then she embarked on a philanthropic project in a badly blighted section of Point Breeze, less than a mile south of their new house. She bought a vacant city block with a single derelict row house standing on one corner. She also bought 5 truckloads of humus and good liability insurance. Her plan was to hire local teenagers at minimum wage, teach them the rudiments of organic gardening, and let them share the profits from whatever vegetables they could sell. She threw herself into her garden project with a manic intensity that was scary even by Robin standards. Brian found her awake at her global desktop at 4 a.m., tapping both feet and comparing varieties of turnip. With a different contractor coming to Panama Street every week to make improvements, and with Robin disappearing into a utopist sink of time and energy, Brian reconciled himself to remaining in the dismal city of his childhood. He decided to have some fun of his own. He began eating lunch at the good restaurants of Philadelphia, one after another, and comparing each to his current favorite, Mare Scuro. When he was sure that he still liked Mare Scuro best, he called the chef and made a proposal. "The first truly cool restaurant in Philly," he said. "The kind of place that makes a person say, 'Hey, I could live in Philly if I had to.' I don't care if anybody else actually feels that way. I just want a place that makes me feel that way. So whatever they're paying you now, I will double. And then you go to Europe and eat for a couple of months at my expense, and then come back and design and operate a truly cool restaurant." "You're going to lose vast amounts of money," Denise replied, "if you don't find an experienced partner or an exceptionally good manager." "Tell me what to do and I'll do it," Brian said.
"Double, you said?
You've got the best place in the city."
"Double is intriguing."
"So say yes."
"Well, it might happen," Denise said, "but you're still probably going to lose vast amounts of money. You're certainly overpaying your chef."